The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Matter Private Network. During current restrictions, don't ignore your health concerns. Our expert team is ready to help.
Luke O'Neill, Professor of Biochemistry at Trinity College in Dublin. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, so much to talk about today. And the first question I will ask you is about AstraZeneca and the question of their yields being disappointing from their facilities. Can you explain to us why we're not getting the amount that we were told we would?
It's a bit disappointing, but isn't it? I mean, there's a contract to supply the amount that the EU was looking for example, and they say they can't meet that demand. Now, I wonder what's going to happen next. Will there be litigation? Because what normally happens is you have a contract with someone and they say, we will supply X, you know, within a certain time frame. There may be riders in the contract, though, if things go wrong that you can't predict, or maybe there are some unknowns. I mean, it's hard to know, but it could be a supply chain issue for them. They can't get the materials quickly enough to make the vaccine, you see. That may be an excuse that they might come up with. And these things happen, by the way. This isn't like making cardboard boxes, you know, it's a very complicated process here. So there may be a couple of things along the way. It wouldn't be unusual to see delays, by the way, often especially in new medicines and biologics and vaccines and so on. These things can happen, you know, but it's certainly a bit disappointing, isn't it? Because we need the vaccines as quick as we can. So you'd wonder what's happened there.
And do we know if it's the nature of this vaccine compared to the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines? This is using a live modified common cold virus as a vector to bring in what you need for the vaccine. Could it be a shortage of the vector?
Yeah. Yeah, they're quite different. They're very different vaccines, in fact. And the Pfizer and Moderna ones are very chemical, if you like. You just make the RNA, stick it into a special liposome, little fatty bag. This AstraZeneca needs these vectors. They need to be grown up, usually. They're more biological. You grow them up and then you put the spike gene into them, you know. So there's more kind of one or two more steps there, maybe. So it could be slightly more technical. But they're used to making these kinds of things. But other vaccines have these vectors, you know. So it's not as if it's a brand new thing where something unexpected was going to happen there. So it could be the plant they're using might have broke things break down. You know, there's all kinds of reasons why there can be a delay. When I was in my previous company, Opsona, we often had delays, one or two things, supply chains and so on, you know. So again, but then the trouble is, this is an emergency, isn't it? So, and the EU is a massive order with AstraZeneca. And I wonder as well, Pat, is the UK going to suffer because of this holdup as well? Is it a general supply problem or is it just the EU? So there's those kinds of questions in our minds.
Which may, as you say, end up in the courts. Now, a couple of other things. Germany has bought a huge amount of the Trump remedy, the monoclonal antibody treatment that was given to Donald Trump. And obviously they're doing this. They're going alone on this one. This is not part of the joint Eurozone purchasing program.
Yeah, but the EU are going to buy this as well, of course. And what Germany has said is that the EU is too slow. So again, there's a criticism then from Germany to the EU, I suppose. And they've looked at, we need this antibody. We need it quickly. We're going to buy loads of it. And it's, again, disappointing in a way. The EU should buy all this for us, shouldn't they? And then divvy it out according to pro rata as usual, you know. But Germany clearly figures, look, we need this now. I think it's like, no more than the AstraZeneca fight is, we're in the middle of an emergency. And countries are going to do whatever they can to some extent. We are supposed to act together in the EU, of course. I'm not sure whether Germany's broken any rules there like they would have with the vaccine when they signed up to waiting for their share, I guess. I'm not sure where the guidelines are on that antibody, but certainly they're aggressively pursuing it. And Pat, we may discuss it on Thursday. Lots more data that antibody works, by the way, in hospitals. Now, it's expensive is the challenge, much more expensive than a vaccine to give to someone, you know. But it's working, and these antibodies are showing more and more promise, and they're stopping people getting really sick in hospital. It's really tremendous, some of the results they're getting from them, you know. So again, Germany would know that. I know that data. We all know the data looks good. It's a great add-on. If someone is in hospital, give them that antibody. And even prophylactically in care homes, there's trials as well, you see. So the data strengthened, basically. And the Germans have gone, right, we want some of that. And they put a massive order in.
Yeah. And if you look at the cost of keeping someone in ICU, perhaps even for 5 weeks, versus you know, a quick dose of this stuff at the beginning, I mean, it may actually make financial sense, as well as obviously for the patient, it makes total sense that they survive, but it could even make financial sense.
Well, the problem, it was always a challenge that it's going to be pricey. I mean, it may be as much as $20,000 per patient in the US, you see. So that's a lot of money, isn't it? But it might be cheaper in Europe. And again, it's about haggling. I bet the Germans will do a deal. Watch with Regeneron trying to get the price down. So it's interesting that. But you're right about if you stop someone from spending 3 weeks in hospital, that's a big saving. More importantly, as importantly, is the long COVID prospect, because this antibody, bit like Trump again, famously, I suspect he hasn't got long COVID. You know, it kills the virus and decreases the risk of long-term problems, which have an economic impact and, of course, a horrible impact on people's health. You know, so there are all kinds of reasons to deploy these antibodies. I suspect, Pat, if the vaccine issue isn't as fast as we like and so on, and as we've discussed, there's a risk of the timelines being pushed out, these antibodies come to the fore very much so as another weapon to use.
Hmm. I saw also a series of papers from all over Europe about vitamin D,
yeah,
and how vitamin D has enhanced the resistance of people to COVID-19. And they've done tests pretty much, they've done papers all over the place to buttress this notion.
They have. That's got stronger and stronger as well. I mean, my great colleague Roseanne Kenny, I think you've spoken to her. She was a big advocate, very much so. Dan McCartney in Trinity as well. There's a Spanish study just came up, and it's a small number, but they still did a trial. There was a big effect of vitamin D supplementation, you know, on those people. So one issue has been there hasn't been randomized, controlled trials. There's one or two. And so there's been a criticism slightly saying do a proper trial. But meanwhile, all this other data is building up of a very strong correlation. The second thing is we know vitamin D is tremendous for the immune system. So in other words, it makes perfect scientific sense that vitamin D would really help the immune system. It helps the macrophages, all kinds of cells. So in other words, there's a strong rationale to make sure people are vitamin D replete, shall we say. There's a recommendation put in the thing today as well, 20 to 25 micrograms per day should be the supplement level. So the people like Roseanne are waiting now for directive. They say, look, would you supplement people with vitamin D, you see? So this data gets stronger all the time.
Mm. And they looked at Finland, where the rate was of COVID was quite low. And it turns out that because of where they are on the globe, that in the winter, they have very long nights and very short days, therefore very little sunlight. They've been putting vitamin D in dairy spreads and in milk and so on for years and years and years and years. So they're making the connection there.
Exactly. That kind of thing gives you information. Again, that's not like a randomized trial, though, is it? It's in the food stuff. But still, absolutely, the Finns have known. We knew vitamin D deficiency affects your bones anyway. Your bones get weaker. You need vitamin D. Vitamin D double jobs in the body, but it helps the bones. Also helps the immune system. Both are important, you know. So again, that kind of data says, look, especially in northern hemisphere places where sunlight is weak, make sure vitamin D is up, especially as you get older, by the way. It's an issue for aging as well, because as people get older, they get more vitamin D deficient, you see. So there's a very strong rationale for giving it to the older population, who we know are at risk, remember. One reason for their vulnerability could be partly to do with vitamin D deficiency, you see. So all of this is really gaining strength.
Now, the allergic reactions that have been reported to the vaccine, you've learned quite a lot more about those.
Yeah, big report just came out on this, which again is tremendous for all kinds of reasons to reassure people, and also full transparency, Pat, which we want, don't we, in the vaccines that we're now looking at. There's a thing called the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, or VAS. That's the standard way you report any kind of adverse event in a vaccine and into a big database. And now they've revealed the data on the allergies, which is a tremendous amount of information. Anybody who wants to can look at it. It's at the CDC website. So in the end, they looked at between the 14th of December and the 23rd, 1.9 million people were vaccinated with the Pfizer vaccine. Nearly 2 million were given the vaccine in that period, December 14, 23. And there were 21 cases of allergy. So very low level allergic reaction. That gives you a rate of 11 per million. Now, it is slightly above the average allergy rate in the population, but even still, tiny numbers. Can you imagine about 21 out of almost 2 million had allergies? And now we've lots of data on them. There were no deaths, which, of course, is the great news. Four were quite severe, had to be hospitalized, and again were treated and came out. And then 17 of 21 had a history of allergy. So they would have had, I think, anaphylaxis, the things like, you know, foodstuffs or, you know, bee sting. One of them had, for instance, you know, so there is a link to a pre-existing allergy. But again, it's very clear. It is serious in those four who end up being hospitalized, of course, and it's something to watch for. Of course it is. The other data, Pat, was it was average time to the reaction was 13 minutes post-vaccination. That was a good little fact as well. And then the symptoms were pretty standard, a rash, you know, tightness in the throat, bit of breathing difficulty, pretty standard for an allergy. And then they were all treated, as I say, and then they were all fine. They were discharged. So we know now this is a very rare thing and it's very manageable. And then lastly, Pat, they've given the guidelines now. We knew them already. Make sure the person given the vaccine has epinephrine and EpiPen ready just in case, and other treatments. 30-minute wait, just to keep an eye on it, even though the average was 13 minutes. Some went on a bit longer. And then the vaccinator should be able to spot the signs and symptoms, obviously. So they're the instructions on the back of this report. But again, it's reassuring, Pat, because it's just such a low level of allergy in response to that Pfizer vaccine.
Now, there were reports that elderly people in Norway died after getting the vaccine. And, you know, they might have died anyway because they were, you know, very, very close to death. And we talked about it last week that, you know, if your body is so weak, giving a vaccine won't necessarily provoke the immune system if it's so weakened that you're on death's door anyway.
That's right. That was looked at closely. Of course it was. But any death is looked at really closely, clearly, you know, and that was clearly a case. Sadly, those who were very old and frail, you know, now whether the vaccine sped up the thing by a few days or whatever, we don't know. But certainly this isn't, it's a concern, obviously, because nobody wants that happening. But it looks like it wasn't caused by the vaccine. Let's put it that way. And now the recommendation, as you saw, is don't give it to people who are very old and very frail, because there's not really any, you know, need. And because there's a worry you might cause something to happen a bit more quickly than it would otherwise, you know. So again, that wasn't necessarily a concern.
Yeah. And the final thing in terms of reaction to vaccines from Israel, they reported a few cases of Bell's palsy, where one half of your face gets slightly paralyzed. Now, it does resolve after a relatively short time.
That's right, Pat. Yeah, that's another one. That came up a little bit like allergies. It's very rare, again. And there's a slight link to the vaccine, but it's extremely rare. And as you say, it does resolve. So again, the level of that above the unvaccinated group is tiny. You know, people are going to get Bell's palsy at a certain rate in the population anyway, you know. So again, that was one that was seen, recorded very carefully. We will see the big report on that soon, just like with the allergy report. And again, so far, nothing untoward to worry about there.
Now, let's talk about ventilation. And you're going back to 400 BC.
I am. We're very learned here, Pat. You know, we know our ancient history, you know. But this is a really, really important thing. Now, you and I have talked about this, and you're interested in engineering that goes back a long way. This is an interest to do with engineering. And whenever I talk about it, engineers get in touch. So it's really good to emphasize this, you know, and it's ventilation. Now, you're right. I mean, the first report of an illness that was spread indoors, shall we say, with poor ventilation was 400 BC by the Greeks. So we've known for a long time certain diseases spread in that way. And now we know there are at least 9 viruses that spread indoors, as we say, and they have a seasonal aspect, you see. So the flu is the big one, obviously. There's still 650,000 deaths from flu, by the way, which is an amazing number when you think of it. Things like the common cold, other coronaviruses that cause the cold. I think a respiratory syncytial virus, RSV. These are all so-called seasonal viruses, and they all spread because you breathe them out, you cough them out. And if you're indoors, that means they spread, you see. That's been known for quite a while. And the big question is, what is it about them? Are they more stable in cold weather, say? That's one question. But it turns out humidity seems to be the key factor here. And if you have a decrease in relative humidity, that's a really bad thing for these viruses. And again, with COVID-19, now the focus is back onto humidity. And of course, Pat, the reason why they're seasonal is largely in winter, we spend 90% of our time indoors. That's the first fact from this study. They looked at that closely, right? So we're all indoors anyway. And then if the air is very lacking in humidity, relative humidity, and it's very dry, then this virus loves it. And the most important thing of all, Pat, here is this virus really does like slightly cold conditions, but it likes a low relative humidity in the air. If that's very low, the virus prefers that and survives. If it's higher, the virus doesn't like it. So suddenly humidity is a key focus now. And the whole idea of putting humidifiers in rooms will become more and more of a thing to look at.
Mm. And some people saying as simple as having houseplants which emit moisture might help you along that road. Interesting, people saying, but if your house is warm, how could you not have humidity? Because warm air will carry more moisture. But it's the air that you're bringing in from the outside is very cold air. And even if it's going through an air conditioner, it still has no moisture in it because it's so cold coming in. And therefore, even when you heat it up, it has no moisture.
let me give you some data, Pat. I mean, the data was tremendous in this study. So if the relative humidity drops below 24%, you're in trouble. That's the kind of key number. And you're quite right. You bring in cold air and you warm it up, and that's a deadly combination because it's a dry, warm air now. And the virus loves that. It spreads like an aerosol around that air. And there was a really good study. They showed that the half-life of the virus, which means how long it takes for half the virus to die, was 24 hours at 10 degrees centigrade, 40% relative humidity, right? That fell to 90 minutes half-life if it was 27 degrees, 65% humidity. So that was a 94% drop in the virus surviving if you had a higher relative humidity and a warm room. Isn't that amazing? So in other words, this is just in an experimental situation, of course. Yeah. So what that tells us, if you have 65% relative humidity, they're recommending 40 to 60%, if people want to know what the relative humidity should be. That's 6 grams per kilogram if you're an engineer. That's a really good humidity because that means the virus in the air is maybe 90% less stable. It's almost as if the virus begins to fall apart at this higher relative humidity, you see, which is tremendous. And then what are they going to have? They've looked in all these, in America now this is done, 40 apartments and houses were examined and 6 workplaces, and all of them had disastrous relative humidity, well below 24%. And that was just measuring it, you know. So we know many workplaces and houses don't have the right level of relative humidity to fight this. It's a simple weapon against the virus, isn't it, in many ways?
Yeah.
You just keep that level up.
You know, for office blocks, sophisticated office blocks, they need perhaps to put somewhere between the air conditioner and the office space, they need to put a humidifier in the pipeline, as it were.
Yeah, some do, of course. These are the lower end of the scale. They looked at loads of workplaces in this, and they were the worst cases, I suppose. So some do have that. Now, the reason why it's important, Pat, is we're all obviously in our homes at the moment. We're not mixing and mingling, are we? It's when we reopen, of course. Then we got to think about humidity. And now in hospitals and workplaces, this report says make sure you, and the WHO, at last, Pat, actually, they've been pressing the WHO on this for a while. They are saying this is an urgent thing to examine to make sure schools, hospitals, workplaces have this relative humidity between 40 and 60%. Because can you imagine, Pat, it's just a simple weapon. In other words, if the virus is in the room and it's floating around in the aerosol, as we know it does, that level of humidity will actually destabilize it and make it much less infectious, is the idea. So again, I think it's a very simple one that needs to be really considered more and more. And this is what's happening, basically. Though now we will see more recommendations on this.
Now, you mentioned temperature there, and we look at that separately from relative humidity. Do we know precisely which temperature SARS-CoV-2 loves?
We do. Again, a huge study on that. Now, as they say in that study, it's not clear if there is an association with cold for definite. In other words, the colder it is, the virus seems to like it. Now, what that means is as you move north up towards the poles, they've done this study now, Pat, the incidence goes up of the virus and the spread. But that could be because we're all indoors. You see, it's hard to know whether that's because the virus is more stable in the cold. But there is a study now showing it likes 10 degrees centigrade, looks like, this virus. That's kind of an optimum temperature to survive in. And that could be part of the thing. And that's one thing. And then for every degree in temperature that went up on the Earth, that's all these huge number of countries were examined and the rate of infection. The cases went down by 0.86. So there was almost one less case per population, and there's a number they use there, as you move south because the temperature goes up, you see. But again, that could be because people are outdoors more. But still, it does look as if the virus is inclined to like slightly cooler temperatures. And we know that from other cold viruses, but they quite like hanging on droplets in the cold air, you know, and that's one reason why colds spread in winter. But the temperature it seems to be a factor, let's put it that way. But it's a bigger factor because it drives us all indoors. That's what they're saying at the moment.
Now, there are a couple of drug-related papers that you've been looking at. There's a drug called colchicine. Is that how you pronounce it? And that's used for gout.
That's right. That's right. Now, if this is true, this is what we're trying to give a bit of good news, don't we? This is an amazing study. Now, again, it's a press release, so the usual caveats. But no more than we looked at press releases for vaccines, why wouldn't we look at a press release for a drug? And this is a very reputable place. It's in Montreal. The statisticians are from Harvard. So we probably can stand over the press release. And if this is true, Pat, this is remarkable, because colchicine is widely used for gout. And it's an anti-inflammatory. And I know a lot about it because I work on what it targets. I think of IL-1, which is the cytokine that we work on, and NLRP3, another favorite of mine. So I've followed colchicine for years. So it's anti-inflammatory. So someone thought, let's try it in COVID, because remember, COVID is an inflammatory disease of the lungs. So big trial, 4,500 people, right? Done properly, double blind, placebo controlled, done in Canada, the EU, the US, South Africa, multiple centres. And the results are striking. In fact, there was a 25% decrease rate of hospitalisation. They gave it to people outside hospital, and 25% decrease in numbers going into hospital. Now, that would have a big effect in any country because you're dropping the rate of hospitalisations. If you ended up in hospital, there was a 50% decrease in mechanical ventilation requirement and a 44% decrease in death rate. Now, they're remarkable. And again, I maybe think it's too good to be true, you know. But I looked closely, and a guy called Pfeffer, who's the chief statistician at Harvard on the program, he said, yes, he says, I'd love to release the paper, he said. I can't at the moment because they're finishing it. They wanted to release the data quickly because they think it's so important. Now, this is a very cheap drug, as cheap as chips, but many people on gout use it. There's one or two side effects, a bit of diarrhea, you know, but that's not a problem. It's still used for gout. So if this pans out, Pat, you could see as soon as someone takes a positive PCR test, and they're at risk of severe disease because they have an underlying condition or they're older, they may be given colchicine. Because if those numbers hold up, you've got a 44% decreased risk of death here, you know? So again, remarkable. And again, it speaks to, if you get in early with an anti-inflammatory, you will protect the lungs. And that's what this is all about, because obviously inflammation ramps up and damages the lungs. And then you get all the various symptoms, you know? So again, that's a striking study. Now, we're waiting for the paper. No more than, you may remember back in November, Pat, we were waiting for the publication of the vaccines. It's a bit like that. But but still, I just think this is a striking one if this turns out to be true.
And the other drug we're going to talk about are something that is used very, very widely, statins, and the effect they may have.
Yeah, that was a clever study. It wasn't done like we're going to give people statins or not, but lots of people are on statins. It's one of the most widely used drugs. It's used to prevent heart disease, as you may know. In fact, they were blockbuster drugs for quite a while, the statins, because they decrease cholesterol. And they do decrease cholesterol. They also protect blood vessels and they're anti-inflammatory. That's what provoked this study in a way, because as we've discussed, it's a blood vessel disease in some ways. That's the coagulation happens in the blood vessels. So they looked at just people who were on statins and who weren't. They had the database and who would be on a statin and who wouldn't. And they controlled it for age and various things. And the ones on statins had a 40% decreased odds of progressing to severe illness. Now, that's a correlation, remember, but it's good because if you happen to be on statins and you get COVID-19, you've almost half the risk of it becoming severe, you see. And it was an even bigger effect if they gave it to people. Some people went into hospital and they started giving them statins because of high cholesterol. And they noticed, oh, hang on, there's something happening with these statins here, you see. So that was another little thing, I suppose. But of course, you need a random placebo controlled trial to confirm. But there were seven different studies were looked at and combined, which gives it more strength. And the bottom line is they're going to do a proper trial. Secondly, if you're on statins, don't come off them. That's the message here, because it would actually could have as much of as a 40% effect on progression to severe disease. So again, I think those two studies combined, Pat, the colchicine and statins, these are commonly used drugs. They're anti-inflammatory. They're supporting the notion, get in early with anti-inflammatories and you will see beneficial effects is the idea. Brilliant. But it's a good study for statins, I guess, because many people in Ireland would be on statins, you see. So again, just stay on them because they will be, it looks like they're going to protect.
Okay, a couple of quick questions. My son has cystic fibrosis. In the past, had an anaphylactic shock due to an allergy to an antibiotic during surgery. Just wondering, will he be at high risk of allergy to the vaccine, or are all vaccines dangerous for him? That's a worried mother.
I wouldn't worry, because again, this business, the advice is just 30-minute observation. And then if something happens, then, you know, you'll be treated fine. Now, remember on that, it was 17 of the people in the overall trial will be like that person, you see, that had a history of allergy. But many people with a history of allergy didn't have an allergic reaction, you know. So it's a very low incidence and very low risk of people who have a history of allergy anyway. And then again, they know what to do, basically. So I wouldn't worry about that. I would take the vaccine and then stay for the 30 minutes and keep an eye on it, you know.
Okay. Another one. Would you ask Luke why the variant has got stronger instead of weaker? Back in March, he was saying that viruses may weaken, not get stronger.
Yeah, great question. We're all scratching our heads on that one. You know, I mean, it's transmitting more. We know that much. That doesn't mean it's any stronger in terms of causing illness. Although, as we saw last week, the UK have flagged up the risk of the UK one being a bit more dangerous and a bit more, problematic. But it's a great question. It's just a random event. It's unusual because usually viruses weaken, you see, for definite, because they don't want to kill you. because they eat your lunch when they infect you, basically, you know. But this is still a work in progress. I think at the moment we need to hold on this because we got to see what the data begins to tell us. We're concerned, of course we are, but we got to keep a very close eye on this, you know, just to see exactly what these new variants are doing, you know.
A lot of people wondering about vitamin D, the dosage for children, for example. Another one, excessive vitamin D levels can carry risks too, can cause heart problems, according to my endocrinologist, says Andrew.
That's true. Yeah. And again, this isn't strong. This isn't sort of a firm recommendation yet. It's just a work in progress, I would say, as well, like many things. There'll be pressure now, though, on the health authorities in several countries to make a statement on this, you see, and say, look, this is what you should do. But that person's very correct. I mean, you can have high dose toxicity is one worry there, you know, other certain groups might need it anyway, you know. So again, I wouldn't be jumping to it yet. I'd wait to see what the final, you know, decision on this would be.
All right, Luke, thank you very much for all of that information. It's fascinating stuff. And as you say, science never sleeps. And particularly during this pandemic, it's a 24/7 job. And we'll talk to you more on Thursday. Luke, thank you very much for joining us.